This is the Heartland Collegiate Compendium. Principles of Microeconomics, Econ 10101. Lecture 26, delivered on the 25th of November of 2008. The title of this lecture is Review for Exam 2.
Today, Review for Exam 2. Let me give you a couple of very specific points right off the bat, things you need to know for Exam 2. As far as chapter material from before Exam 2, as I've indicated, you will not be asked specifically about that material, but you could be asked about problems that involve earlier material. So, for example, in the previous part of the course, I brought up the industry organization spectrum from perfect competition on through monopoly. After exam one, I went on to talk more in detail about those matters. Specifically, I will have you calculate a Hirschfeld-Herfindahl index. Second, and in that same regard, I don't know if I've got a question here that somewhat might be a little obtuse, and I might take that one out. I'm not completely thrilled with that question, but in terms of monopoly, just to keep on that subject for a moment or two here, I do intend to ask you about antitrust law. Know the laws, the sequence of them, and the details. Sherman Antitrust Act, which dealt with conspiracies and all that kind of thing. And then the amendment to it, which was the Clayton Act, then the Federal Trade Commission Act, and an amendment to the Federal Trade Commission Act. Well, the Federal Trade Commission Act gives the FTC broad authority to oversee industry practices and to find unfair and deceptive business practices. However, that was actually language in an amendment to the Federal Trade Commission Act, but nonetheless, it's part of the Federal Trade Commission Act. Now, as far as the last act of Congress, that, remember, the Clayton Act was an amendment to the Sherman Antitrust Act. And the Clayton Act was an amendment that gave specificity to the Sherman Antitrust Act. However, the Sherman Antitrust Act was successful in breaking a couple of monopolies up. Make sure you know what the Sherman Antitrust Act did accomplish. Now, the Clayton Act got down to specifics. Specifically, it outlawed exclusivity clauses. And I gave you details of several different kinds of exclusivity clauses. You remember what those were? Tie-in sales and? No. Tie-in sales and bundling. Know what those are. Know that they were part of the Clayton Act. Know also what else the Clayton Act prohibited. Know which act it was that prohibited price discrimination. Know also whether or not a loss leader. If I described a loss leader to you, would that be a violation? If it is not a violation, why is it not a violation? Make sure that you go back in your notes and look up per se violations. I gave you a discussion or a description of the two criteria that would have to be met for a prosecutor to successfully get a conviction under Sherman or Clayton. And then I went on to explain that there is an exception to the two-layered requirement. And that is called And we call violations that have to meet only the first tier per se violations. Do you remember what it is that in a per se violate, what a per se violation is? Go ahead. The effect. The effect. You see, normally it would be first you have to have done it, and then something bad has to have happened from it. Some adverse market concentration has to have happened. But in a per se violation, all that has to be established is that there was the violation itself by the letter of the law. In a sense, I can't remember whether I told you this or not. We call those thou shalt not laws. Okay? And unfortunately, a lot of law that applies to people is that thou shalt not kind of law. It doesn't matter whether any damage was done, you'll still be ticketed. You break the speed limit. Doesn't matter if you didn't hurt anybody, you broke the speed limit, thou shalt not. You get nailed for it. Now, what you're thinking of is another concept in law, which we talk about, we use a term called mens rea. And then there's a variation on that called actus rea. Mens rea, the criminal mind, actus rea, you did something bad. Okay, and you're thinking of that. That's we don't deal in civil law. Well, we do, but not that kind of law.
Murdered my company.
Wouldn't matter if you actually murdered it or not. In a per se violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act, it wouldn't matter whether you murdered the company or not. You did the act, and that's all that mattered. And interestingly enough, in the prosecution of Microsoft, the principal focus of the prosecution was on whether or not Microsoft did these things. The whole idea of them destroying companies like Netscape and all of that, sure they did, but that's not the issue. Because the focus was on per se violations. You did this. Let's not even get into the whole mess of who got hurt and how much, what industries got concentrated too much. Let's just look at, did you do it? Oh, mother's work is never done. Let me get a real quick, before I forget, these last couple of lectures on things like auctions. Okay, make sure you know the different kinds of auctions. If I described an auction to you, would you be able to tell me what kind of an auction we're talking about? We are starting the bid for Ms. X over here at $20. Do I hear $25? God. Come on, man. Someone. Oh, well, whatever. Okay. What kind of an auction is that? English. That's an English auction. Okay. And those are very common. What was the good example that I gave you of a Dutch auction? Houses, yeah. Because they start at a high list price and then the price goes down until someone buys the house. And that's the way those normally work. Interestingly, in corporate takeovers, where there's a fight for a company by other companies, those end up being English auctions, as different companies, if you have two predators who want to take a company, they'll off-tender at higher and higher prices to take that company over. But on the other hand, you will see Dutch auctions in some circumstances where, for example, in the current economic crisis, you'll essentially see companies that are in such desperate shape, they'll go to try to find someone with a company with which to merge. They'll start out saying, we want $2.5 billion, and the company walks away. Okay, fine, we want $2 billion. So that's more like a Dutch auction. Interestingly enough, union negotiations, labor management negotiations, those often come out, okay, let me ask you, what do you think those are? in wage negotiations. What kind? They're Dutch. Right. Because usually the union goes in with all kinds of very high requirements. We want a pay increase of 12%. And by the end of the negotiations, it has been whittled down to 4%, something like that. So that would be an example of a Dutch auction. That's the kind of question that I might ask you on the exam. Is I'll describe a kind of auction and say, all right, what kind of, I'll describe an auction, something that's actually real probably. And then I'll ask you, okay, what kind of an auction was that? Know what winner's curse is. Know what winner's curse is. I wish I had the time. I would show you. Winner's curse is beginning, in my judgment, to simply overrun eBay. I have watched, I actually have participated in 5 auctions in the last week where I stepped back because the bidding went above the price of the product new. One was so dramatic. I could get this product for about $600, brand new, warranty, box, everything. And yet the auction for a used version of it that was about a year old, the auction went to like $750. And that's winner's curse. And so know what winner's curse is, okay? And try to avoid getting suckered into winner's curse, because it's just terrible what can happen in regard to that. Also, know what a forward contract is. And know what I mean by spot. Essentially, I'm teaching you a little bit of language here that can make you sound really sophisticated when you're working in certain fields. Well, spot is, I might describe a kind of forward contract and describe give you some numbers, and I'll say, okay, what's spot, what's forward, and all of that kind of stuff. Spot, remember, is the price that is prevailing, as opposed to a forward price, which would be a contracted, agreed-upon price. Now, forward contracts don't necessarily have to be only price. They can be quantity as well. Guaranteeing, for example, the company that picked up the oil from our oil and gas operations, they guaranteed that they would take all of our oil in the forward and things like that. Forward contracts can involve, we will take all of whatever you produce. If you're a small manufacturer, that's a wonderful thing. If you've got a single distributor who will say, we'll take as much of this as you can produce, that's technically a forward contract, agreeing in advance to take as much as you have. Okay. Now, I gave you an article to read, Pumpkins and Futures. I'm not going to ask you any real of the hard math of it. The math got a little obtuse, if you notice. It's not hard math, but it's kind of weird the way way futures contracts work is that they actually renew every day. A futures contract actually ends at the end of every day, and then it renews at the beginning of the next day. And also, futures contracts, if you want to get out of a futures contract, you don't just get out of it. You don't just let it expire. You actually have to take a matching opposite position to get out of the futures contract. That's how that works. I will ask you something about futures contracts. It will not be some complicated little financial thing, how much did you make on this contract and all that. It will just be some concept that has to do with the futures market. And also make sure that you know what I mean by price discovery. I have talked about this over and over in this course, and in that article, Pumpkins and Futures, I bring up the concept of price discovery again, and the crucial role of speculators in price discovery. Speculators, between you and me, are the scum of the earth. Speculators are lower than low. They're worse than Hannah Montana. And they are bad. They're greedy. They're disgusting. They are. You don't want to know speculators. Some of them are the nastiest people I ever met, creepy as hell. And I'm speaking from experience with these people. I was in that world. However, they are crucial. Just like bacteria You know E. coli bacteria? That E. coli is necessary for you to live. It's disgusting. It stinks. You've seen giant piles of E. coli probably about every night of your life. However, its function is necessary to the market, and that's what speculators are. In futures markets and in markets like that, it's the speculators that drive the price discovery process. Where it can go awry, though, is when there are concentrations that have market impact. Speculators that are actually so big that you no longer get the Adam Smith atomistic world. Then you can have the speculators actually move prices adversely to fair market value. But that's another thing. Know a couple of terms or concepts from the futures article that I gave you. I will ask about those on the exam. Guaranteed satisfaction on that one. Let me look up something real quick here. I want to... Now, as I told you, with respect to marginal factor cost, marginal revenue product, I will not ask you numerical types of questions. However, you have an example, you have a couple of examples on a quiz where I asked you about the configuration of the marginal factor cost curve and the labor supply curve. Make sure you know the answer to questions like that. If a market for, if the labor market is in perfect competition, what is the relationship of the labor supply curve to the marginal factor cost curve? Can you answer that? Again, someone said no. let's try this again. If a labor market is in perfect competition, let's start with that. If a labor market is in perfect competition, what does the labor supply curve look like? Let's start. Let's get basic here. Yeah, it's what? Not a vertical line. Horizontal line. Concentrate. At least that's better than people who say it's a straight line. Grr. Yeah, it's a horizontal line. It's a flat, perfectly elastic at a prevailing wage. Classic example of that would be an unskilled market. Let me ask a quick question. True or false? The unskilled labor market does not include you. True or false?
False?
Yes. You can do unskilled labor. You can be an animal. You can be a beast of burden. You can be the cook at McDonald's. Oh, that's not actually unskilled. I shouldn't do that one. You can be a teacher at this college. No, that one's even harsher. See, that's the whole thing, is that it's almost like a pyramid. Everyone is in the lowest layer. And then even above the lowest layer, marginally skilled, most of us would be. But what we're trying to do is we're trying to be in those markets, but also be in the higher markets as well, where the labor supply curve gets more and more inelastic. Okay, now, if the labor supply curve is perfectly elastic, what can you tell me about the marginal factor cost of labor curve? It is... Yeah, it's perfectly elastic on the labor supply curve. Because the marginal cost of every last worker is the same as the worker before them. You're paying the same wage no matter how many of them you buy, because there's so damn many of them. Therefore, you are going to, the last one is going to cost you what the one previous to it did. Okay, now, let's go on from there. If the labor supply curve is not perfectly elastic, where is the marginal factor cost curve?
Above it.
And the reason for that is because you will probably, one of the reasons, most important, is you're probably going to end up having to pay every worker for what you pay the last worker. And if you have to pay if I have to pay you more than I paid you, your marginal cost is higher than yours, then you're going to start bitching at me and I'm going to end up having to pay you more. Okay, not that I want to, because you're not productive. Oh, okay. Sorry, I'm getting into being my old managerial self again. Okay, but that's an awfully simplistic explanation, but it works, and it gives you an idea of why it's that same phenomenon you saw with marginal revenue curves. When the perfect competition, when the demand curve price-taking curve, the demand curve of a price-taking curve, a firm is perfectly elastic. The marginal revenue curve is parked right on it because the price of the product is the same no matter how many you sell. But if the demand curve starts to tip downward, as it does in monopolistic competition or monopoly, monopolistic competition in the short run or in monopoly, then you get into another world entirely. You start to see the marginal revenue curve tip under it. Again, I will not ask you numerical questions about that, but I will ask you some more configurations types of questions. I might also ask you, as most of you found, you did a nice job on that, most of you did on that tape, those tables, which were grueling, I will admit, to do. But you found that, for example, if I were to talk about a price-taking firm and a competitive labor market, and I were talking about comparing that to a price-seeking firm and a non-competitive labor market, which market would you see more people being hired in, all other things being equal? Again, I've got an industry that is where the firms are price seekers, another price takers, competitive. And you've got a labor market where there is highly competitive versus a labor market where the firms buying the labor are non-competitive, they're price seekers, they have downward sloping demand curves, and the labor market is non-competitive. In other words, there's not a perfectly elastic supply of labor. Which one would you see more labor being hired in? For God's sake, use common sense here. Yeah. See, in the second one, I'm talking about a monopoly, okay, on the buying side of the labor market. Monopolies always produce less and charge a higher price for their product. If they're producing less, then obviously they'll need less labor, right? If they produce less, then they won't need as many workers to do it, unless, of course, they're the government. And on the other side, in a competitive labor market, every last worker is paid some flat prevailing wage. In a non-competitive market, if you want to hire more people, you have to pay them more and more and more as you bring more in. Which market, if you were a businessman, would you or a businesswoman, would you rather be in? If you're one where you're paying everyone the same flat low wage, or one where every time you hire some person, you have to pay more to him, which would you rather see?
Same thing.
Yeah, and you would hire more in that kind of a labor market. You would hire a lot more people if you had to pay all of them the minimum wage than if you had to pay progressively more and more and more as you brought more people into your business. So you're clearly, and you saw it in that example, those tables, how the number of workers was highest in a competitive, in a price taking business with competitive labor supply. That was the highest possible amount of labor that could be acquired. The lowest amount was in the price seeking firms, industry of price seekers, where there is non-competitive labor. Okay, enough of that. Enough of that. Risk. Make sure you know about things like, there's terminology. Now, I'm not going to be exhaustive here, but know about moral hazard. Know about adverse selection. Moral hazard and adverse selection are biggies. Okay, make sure you know about those, okay? And also, what's the first principle of finance?
Oh.
Okay, that's okay. You will by the time of the exam, right? Okay, good, good, good. First principle of finance. Anyone know what the first principle of finance is? The greater the risk, the greater the expected return. You don't get something for nothing. If you want more, you have to take a greater risk. If you want to make a lot of money in your life, you can't sit in your basement eating Cheetos and playing World of Warcraft. You know, that's
really, really good.
Well, actually, you know, what's really scary is there. Have you seen the people who sell their characters?
I was reading something. Some guy has like 30 different accounts on there.
At least he won't breed, you know, because he's playing too much. But some of the prices that they're paying, there's a guy, I ran into a couple of players who are selling some of their actual accounts in the range of $50,000 because they're so high, they're so powerful in their guilds, they can make a fortune. I, you know, what the hell?
Someone spending $50,000.
Well,
that's not half as bad as the people who get married within the game.
Oh, and that Sims, you know, thing too, and Second Life. I mean, that's getting out of hand, man.
What's the point? Why don't you just go outside and live? I
mean, you know, didn't you see there's a woman who's divorcing her husband because of his affair in Second Life? You know? Yo, man, dude. I don't care how good your computer is. It ain't that good. No. Okay. I'm not sure how I'm going to frame this, because my question here, I always look at these questions and think, this question, the way I've got it framed, I'm looking right at a question here, it really sucks the way I've got it framed. I'm going to have to fix it. I don't know if I'll be able to fix it completely, but here it is. Something along the lines of the concept of diversifiable versus non-diversifiable risk. It's a hugely important concept. You should expect a reward for bearing risk. There's no doubt about that. That's how markets work. You're not rewarded for hiding in your basement. However, you are also not rewarded for risks that you don't have to take. You don't get a reward for bearing risk that is unnecessary. At least in efficient markets. Now, in some markets, it looks like unnecessary risk, but it's actually necessary to the market. Like, for example, the people in some take extraordinary dangers, but they're getting reward for those dangers because of the risk that they're taking. However, if you are, for example, a NASCAR driver, you will make no more money by not wearing safety equipment than you will by wearing safety equipment. There are diversifiable risks. There are risks that are removable. There was a video that was, it was yesterday that some fellow, a speedboat racer at 240 miles an hour, he barrel rolled his speedboat, completely obliterated the thing. He was not rewarded for being stupid, but he got some cred. He was wearing all kinds of safety equipment. The whole point there is that you're not rewarded for doing things that you don't have to do, unless that's why you're being paid, like in a movie like Jackass, although they weren't really being paid for that. I mean, they were just stupid people.
So David Blaine is another example of that.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, what was that? Fear Factor. Oh. Did any of you ever watch that show? Is that still on now?
I mean,
some of those things. You don't have to do what they were doing. But, for this particular purpose. Now, if you did that, the guy who stuck his head up in this box with like 100 tarantulas in there crawling around him, now, I would not pay you. I don't think anyone in this room would really pay you. We'd watch you do it, and the minute you twitched, all 100 of them would bite you, and then your head would expand like Mr. Potato Head. But by the way, I just noticed something here. As far as, let's go back, with the Hirschfeld-Herfindahl Index, or Hirschman, or whatever that is. It's the HH, whatever. Make sure you know what the endpoints mean. Where the endpoints are and what they mean. Something I just realized here. Let me check one thing real quick here. I'm looking at a couple of... Oh, I lied. There is going to be something from the exam 1. The most important thing that I've told you to get this tattooed on you. The most important idea of profit maximization. Where is profit maximization? What is the criterion? What is the equilibrium condition? Know it. I've asked it on the exam. I've asked it on a quiz. I will ask it again just to make absolutely sure that you know it. Principle of diminishing marginal productivity. I brought that up early in the course, but I had to go back and revisit it, so that's going to be another thing that I could ask about as well. Make sure you know about the two factors that determine the shape of a labor supply curve. There is the opportunity cost that's involved, but there are two effects. What are they? I'll give you a hint. One of them is the substitution effect. The other is the income effect. If the substitution effect dominates the income effect, then a labor supply curve will be... Now, I did this on a quiz. Yeah, you didn't do so well there. Make sure you know this for the exam because I will ask this again. If the substitution effect dominates the income effect, then the labor supply curve will be upward sloping. But if the income effect dominates the substitution effect, then the labor supply curve will be negatively sloped. That's why we will see backward bending labor supply curves, is because in the early low wages, the substitution effect dominates the income effect, but in higher wages, leisure becomes so valuable that you will actually trade back off. The income effect is dominating the substitution effect. So we will see the phenomenon of backward bending labor supply curves if at low wages, the substitution effect dominates the income effect, but at high wages, the income effect dominates the substitution effect. Make sure you know that. Go back and revisit that. That's on, I can't remember which quiz that was on. I asked that. But get that right, because I will ask that, and I might hit it a couple of times. As a matter of fact, I think I do actually hit that a couple. Okay. Let me check something real quick here. I'm going to give you one more pointer. Grr, that wasn't what I wanted. There we go. Okay, now let me make sure that I get you through the details of monopolies and perfect competition. After I had, at exam one, we terminated, I had gone through the taxonomy of industry types. And I had brought up a few details about what the different industries look like in terms of the assumptions that we made and all of that. Remember that I talked about perfect competition. We assume that there are highly competitive markets and all of that, and the demand curve facing the individual firm is at the prevailing price level set at the market. And I talked about monopoly has a downward sloping demand curve. It is on this exam where I get the details of that down, where I begin to ask you the specific questions about the monopoly and the perfect competition firm and all of that. For one thing, look on your quizzes, revisit your quizzes. You'll see a question that I did where I showed you a monopoly, essentially a firm that was in a monopoly. And I said, all right, here, what I want you to do is tell me how much will be produced and what the price will be for it, okay? I will ask that again on this exam. That will be something that I will ask. Go back, revisit your quizzes. You'll see where I did that. I actually drew the graph out and demonstrated and had you find the profit maximizing output for the monopoly. And you would want to be able to do the profit maximizing output level and price in a monopolized industry. And looking at that same graph, I would expect you to be able to tell me what the price would be in an industry in competition. So remember that in a monopoly, you are looking for where marginal cost hits marginal revenue, And then at that output level, you see what the demand will bear. In perfect competition, you're looking at where supply equals demand, because the supply curve and the demand curve intersecting will create a prevailing price that will be imposed upon the individual firm.
And that's same, to be more specific, I will actually, just to make sure that you have got this, and this may overlap a little bit of the first exam material, but not really, because I didn't ask you a lot of these questions. I'll ask you to give me some of the assumptions. I'll ask you about assumptions for different types of markets. In perfect competition, what would you see? What would you not see? What is the distinguishing visible? And I'll ask you this right now. What is the visible evidence of an industry that is in monopolistic competition? Bingo. If you see advertising, you are probably looking at an industry in monopolistic competition. What is the purpose? What is the purpose of advertising? Bingo! Oh, I love it when you talk like that. Yeah. Makes my man chest swell. Yes! Didn't need to know that. That's exactly right. The whole point of advertising is to differentiate your product. Because in differentiating your product, what are you trying to do to the demand curve? Make it slope downward. Make it somewhat inelastic. Because then the marginal revenue curve drops under it. So marginal cost equals marginal revenue at a lower output level, which means you can charge a higher price. That is the huge characteristic of of monopolistic competition. What distinguishes it? Now you will see monopolies and oligopolies advertise sometimes. A lot of that is to the purpose of giving consumers a feel-good attitude about a company for political reasons. You saw Microsoft advertising around the turn of the century with that little butterfly and that kind of stuff, the colorful butterfly. The whole point of that was to get themselves looking good because they were in the final stages of a battle with the government in court to make people feel happy about them, feel good. As a matter of fact, there are accusations that some of these companies that are in these serious monopoly antitrust battles actually pay people to go on message boards and defend the companies. I mean, it's kind of weird because you will actually see, I shouldn't even talk, there are rumors. I was paid to go on message boards to defend companies and to attack anyone who criticized them. And it's a living, you know. But at the same time, make sure you know about I'm just going back and cleaning up a couple of things here real quick. Oh, you're talking about that those creeps, those weird, that cult, the Phelps, I guess it is Phelps, yeah.
That reminds me of one of them going into a gay bar and telling them how wonderful Mr. Phelps is.
Sure, well, they wouldn't last long in there, I can assure you of that. But at the same time, it depends on what they're in there really for. Cartels, and make sure I brought up the survivorship principle. I want you to know what it is. Make sure you know what the survivorship principle is. And what question, well, this is kind of hard for you, probably without studying, I'm sure. Could anyone tell me what was the question that the survivorship principle did a fairly interesting, good job of explaining? I know this was a difficult one,
but it had to do with why we would see two industries that were servicing the same consumer universe with radically different competition levels in them. The two industries that service the same Americans, same number, one would be highly competitive, many, many small firms fiercely fighting with each other. But there would also be an industry servicing those same people that was an oligopoly or virtually a monopoly. Why would that be? How did that come about? What was the point? What was going on there? And while I'm thinking about it, I want you to make sure, and I have not asked this, I want you to know what characterizes a natural monopoly. What characterizes a natural monopoly? There is one thing, and it has a consequence, and it has to do with the graphs of natural monopolies. You know what it is? Remember what natural monopolies' long-run average cost curve looks like? You remember? Yeah, it's like this. It's actually never turns back up. Normal long-run average cost curves have that U shape. These don't. Now, I did the long-run average cost curve on the first exam. However, going on, I want to emphasize, I want to go back so that you understand that this has a major consequence because if you have a long-run average cost curve that never turns upward, it just keeps falling. In other words, as you get bigger, your unit cost gets lower and lower and lower. It never turns upward. If that is the case, if your long-run average cost curve never actually turns upward, remember that the marginal cost curve intersects the average cost curve at the bottom of the average cost curve. That's just it's just a mathematical thing. So if the long run average cost curve never turns upward, the long run marginal cost curve can never break up and come through it. So that means that the cost of the last user gets closer and closer to zero no matter how large the company gets. The consequence of that is that essentially it becomes virtually costless to add another customer as a natural monopolist. And so the whole idea in business, everything about business has to do, at least in normal business, your pricing is based upon what the cost of the last customer is. You charge to at least something along the line of the cost of the last person that is going to go into your business. So that when you look at a normal business, remember that marginal cost curves are always, they're upward sloping like that, okay? So essentially, wherever you are in your output level, as you sell more of it, your marginal cost for your last customer is going to be higher. And so when you price, you want to be pricing at the cost of the last customer, or at least have some relationship to the cost of the last customer. That's why we do things like cost plus pricing. What you're really doing there as a business person is marginal costs are actually not that easy to see, but average costs are. So when you do cost plus pricing, you're taking your average cost and you're saying, all right, we're going to add something to that. We're going to add something to that. That's supposed to go right through the bottom of that. Wherever we are, we know what our unit cost is. So we're going to plus on that to try to find a little bit closer to where our marginal cost is. That's basically what cost plus pricing is all about. Is you know what your average cost is, you plus something on that, and that gets you to about where you would be in terms of the marginal cost of the last customer. So we really are, even if we don't talk about it so much in business, we're always trying to price somewhere along the lines of where you, my last customer, would cost me to bring you in and sell you a product. But with a natural monopolist, their marginal cost, when they're huge, they have virtually no cost to their last customer. That makes for a really weird pricing strategy for them. Because essentially, they can price, this is very loose and I know I should be shot for saying this. They can charge whatever the hell they want to you. They can charge you a huge price, or they could charge you virtually nothing. It's like Verizon Wireless or any of these companies, especially a Verizon. They'll bring you in almost at a, you know, we'll waive your setup fee. Here, we'll give you a damn really nice phone. Anything. Just join us. Because the cost of bringing you in is nothing. And then they can get a revenue stream from you. And that's the whole point of it. I made the mistake of getting a family plan because, you know, I have a daughter, 15 years old. And of course, I had no idea, you know, texting apparently is rather big. And I didn't realize that. And they charged me like 10 cents for every text message. I got my first bill after I brought her in. And I called the guys on the phone at Verizon. Oh, you have a daughter. Oh, she text messages. And I was there. I can't afford this. You know, I'll have to sell my car. I'll have to sell my daughter to white slavery. And they said, oh, don't worry about it. We'll just waive it this time and put you on a nice plan. You know, 500 free messages a month. Oh, I see that won't be enough. 1,000 free messages a month. They waived it off. They waived the money off that I had incurred on the last bill. What? What the hell? I don't need you treating me nice like this. But they did. Why? What? Why not? They got their revenue stream from me. Their marginal cost of bringing me in is zero, virtually zero. All they have to do is throw a switch. So they can do those kinds of things. That creates powerful loyalty within the customer base. That's the kind of thing that makes you, I'll never leave Verizon. And so they can create even more market concentration. As they get larger, they can just drive anyone out of the market with those kinds of, that kind of ability to charge as much as they want when they want to, or charge as little as they want when they want to. And did any of you, by the way, take advantage of that package that I put up on the website where you could get Microsoft's Ultimate Office 2007? A couple of you did. Excellent. Most excellent. They didn't have to charge you 50, yeah, it was what? A little under 60 bucks, right? Something, yeah. And I mean, do you know how much that costs at retail? They can charge yuppies at State Barn $600. And they can charge you just a little bit, because it actually, the cost of giving you the product was just a little bit of bandwidth on their servers. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.